Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in History. My name is Isabel Moore, and I'm a host on the channel. Today, my conversation is with Emily Hobson, an assistant professor of history and of gender, race, and identity at University of Nevada, Reno, and a scholar activist. Today, we're talking about her book, Lavender and Red, Liberation and Solidarity in the Gay and Lesbian Left, published by University of California Press in 2016. In the book, Hobson examines gay, lesbian, and queer radicalism from the late 1960s through the end of the Cold War in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Isabel Moore, one of the hosts of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Emily Hobson about her book, Lavender and Red, Liberation and Solidarity in the Gay and Lesbian Left. Emily Hobson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Emily, I wonder if you could start by just telling us a little bit about your background, personal and academic, and how you became interested in the study of history.
Sure. So my interest in history, and especially in social movement history, began when I was pretty young. I often date it to watching Eyes on the Prize as a child, including with my parents, and that we watched it together, and they would pause and talk about their reactions at the time, and I could see their emotional reactions to the history being recounted. So that had a big impact on me, both learning that history in a way that was accessible to me at the time as a kid in middle school, and I think also seeing the meaning that it still held for, you know, people who I didn't think about as hugely political or activist. So that kind of sparked my interest from a young age. So then I brought that interest definitely into college, into the activism I was getting involved in college. And after my junior year, I took a year off from undergraduate education because I wanted to be doing activism full time, basically, and also really had no idea what I could do after I graduated and kind of saw a lot of people around me very kind of confident of some next step they were taking, often a very kind of clear professional step into law school, into graduate school, and then even people I knew who I had been organizing with on campus, but who were going into, you know, banking and kind of careers that seemed odd to me given their other interests. And they were, many of them were going into that kind of work really to kind of pay down loans. And because it was a clear path, like they could sort of clearly take it. So I took a year off after my junior year because I didn't want to just go into something kind of already predetermined. I didn't think I wanted to go straight into graduate school, even though that was the clearest thing I could imagine myself doing, maybe eventually becoming a professor. And I had been an undergraduate at Harvard. I went across the country to the Bay Area because it struck me as sort of the place I thought of as a place with all kinds of social justice organizing going on. And worked there for a year including for a community organizing group that existed at the time called the Center for Third World Organizing, and then went back, finished the BA, and after graduating, moved back to the Bay Area for another several years. And one of the things that living in the Bay Area really reinforced for me was not just the kind of experience I got doing both paid and unpaid organizing work, but also the kind of what it was like to live in a place with a still at that time a pretty strong connection to a radical past, you know, whether in the form of murals in neighborhoods or lots of different community events where you could go kind of hear from longtime activists reflecting on the importance of a particular kind of political moment, or kind of the ways that radical history was interwoven into the music scene, into kind of other kinds of cultural scene. So I would say that the kind of from that early interest as a kid to then living in the Bay Area and seeing this kind of radical history all around me really helped me to then go into graduate school, knowing that I wanted to study social movements and to write about them, to write about radical history, but with a kind of connection back to some of the ways that that could really hold meaning for people outside of the academy and in movement building day to day.
Great. So how did that trajectory take you into writing this particular book?
Yeah, so I didn't really get to learn much queer history as an undergraduate, and I got a bit of a sense of it after graduation just through, you know, the kind of political scene I was part of, and through my own process of coming out. I came out really after college, despite a number of fits and starts during college, I would say. But I still wasn't really grounded. You know, I didn't have like a rich training in queer history at all. And some of that was, of course, that it is still a relatively young field, right? It was just difficult to find people doing work in the field. I was an undergraduate from 1993 to 1998. And the courses I could take in queer studies were almost entirely literary theory, kind of cultural studies. I really don't remember even opportunities to learn about to kind of think through LGBTQ experiences in a really historical way. So when I went into graduate school, I knew that that was kind of something I was hoping to do, was to kind of enrich some of my training on queer topics, although I didn't actually apply thinking I wanted to do a queer history project. But I started to do some, you know, poking around, investigation of possible research topics during my first year in graduate school. And one of the things I was doing was I developed a directed reading with David Roman, who became one of my committee members, on archives and primary sources from the kind of height of the emergence of gay liberation. Because I was really interested to look at how were people really talking about the movement at its emergence. And one of the things I noticed was just how incredibly multi-issue a lot of the politics was, but that that wasn't yet reflected in some of the scholarship on the period. And also how many kind of unspoken assumptions there were in some of the primary sources about that kind of broader political context. So, for example, I remember watching and trying to take apart the documentary Word Is Out, which was put together and then released in 1977 and 78. And it's a documentary that doesn't really have an extremely radical agenda. It is a documentary that was, you know, screened on PBS. It has this intention of showcasing kind of a broad range of gay and lesbian experiences around the United States. It's fairly tokenistic in its approach to including people of color. You know, so it kind of tries to do this, you know, here's a catalog of all the different types of gay people and all of their experiences in coming to understand their sexuality and coming out. And, you know, so in and of itself, it doesn't express the kind of politics I ultimately came to describing in Lavender and Red. But I kept noticing that throughout the interviews, you would see people making references to this broader kind of radical context, or to, you know, they might be wearing buttons or have posters in the background of the room that they're being interviewed in. For example, one of the people in the film is Teddy Matthews, who has a pretty prominent place in Lavender and Red. And in his Word Is Out interview, he's wearing a button for the Inés García campaign. He's, you know, very clearly talking about these kind of radical interconnections. And in fact, the scholar Greg Yeomans has done some really wonderful work about Word Is Out in particular. But of course, that came out later after I had first dived into the project. But those were some of the connections that I was trying to figure out was, you know, what was the bigger context through which gay liberation and lesbian feminism developed, and why has that kind of richer array of politics not, you know, been talked about? Why has the story of queer activism so much focused in on an effort to determine the kind of single issue story? And what does that leave out?
Wow. So from there, as you're looking into all these archives, how did you arrive at, I assume this is your dissertation book, your dissertation took form and moved into the book?
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's just jump into the book. So you took all of that background that you were seeing, and in your book, you focus on gay, lesbian, and queer radicalism from the late 60s, really through the 90s and into the 2000s in your epilogue, using the Bay Area of California as a case study. So in your first chapter, you're looking at gay men from 1969 to 1973. Could you tell us about the roots of their radicalism, the debates they had, how they came to build coalitions and prioritize that kind of work?
Sure, absolutely. So, right, the first chapter focuses in on radical gay men, whereas the second looks primarily at lesbian feminists, and then from there it's a fairly co-gender story or multi-gender story. So in the first chapter, I'm really kind of trying to think through some of the rhetoric that radical gay men were developing. So precisely what did gay liberation mean to them, and what was the broader context of liberation through which gay liberation was being defined? And one of the things you can see from a lot of the early documents of gay liberation, is that first of all, the movement is developing in part through people writing and thinking. Of course, it's also developing through, you know, performance, through street protests, through, you know, people's love lives, through people's community formation, through their collective living, all kinds of different ways that the movement is developing. But one of the clearest ways to track it is through the radical underground press, and then, of course, more specifically, the beginnings of gay and lesbian newspapers that are not entirely controlled by the earlier homophile movement. So this kind of new gay liberation newspapers are a really important archive for the first chapter. Come Out, Gay Sunshine, and a number of other publications. And in the pages of those publications, you really see people trying to define what is the politics of being gay and of anti-gay oppression? How is anti-gay bias, oppression, et cetera, you know, interconnected with structures of racism, of capitalism, of U.S. imperialism? How is it different? How is it unique? But also, how is it interwoven? And so the first chapter really tries to trace out what arguments people were making. And one of the big debates I started to see was a kind of debate over the use of analogy between sexuality and race. So gay as like black, especially as a really important comparison. And then a borrowing of kind of terminology from, in particular, Black radicalism, but also other kinds of race-based and anti-racist organizing. So, for example, the chapter title includes this heavily debated term, the gay ghetto. So if we're going to describe the experience of anti-gay oppression as somehow making gay men's experiences as somehow like a ghetto, what does that mean? What does it imply? Is it a, you know, is it a correct kind of analogy to make? How might it reframe thinking about oppression more broadly? And what I saw was that there emerged really quickly early on a critique of the limits of analogy. So a lot of activists saying, look, sexuality and race are two different kinds of categories. And especially for gay white men to say that they're experiencing the same thing as racism just doesn't make sense. And it obviously leaves out the experiences of queer people of color, or, you know, third world gay people, as the term was going at the time. But it also, it doesn't even get at some of the actual connections in terms of police brutality, in terms of treatment within the military, and so forth. So on the one hand, there's this pushback against kind of too sloppy use of analogy. But on the other hand, there's an effort to say that, okay, although the analogy is flawed, there are these kinds of interconnections through things like experiences of the police, and that if we start to look at how anti-gay oppression isn't just localized within a particular neighborhood, then we kind of see how there is a kind of, there's a form of alienation that people are experiencing, you know, a kind of isolation from one another as well as from kind of mainstream society. And so I could sort of see the ways that people were using a language of really a kind of geographic scale to think about how anti-gay structures were really kind of operating at the level of people's individual bodies, and therefore how gay liberation was starting to articulate how men might remake their own gender expression along with, you know, opposing the Vietnam War, standing in solidarity with Black power, and so forth. So it's a complex argument in that first chapter, but it is kind of trying to think through the types of comparisons that people are making and how it is that they're beginning to conceptualize gayness as connected to, although different from, other structures of oppression.
Wonderful. And you do some similar work in your next chapter on lesbian feminism and their philosophy of collective defense. Could you tell us about what you found when you looked at lesbian feminists during an overlapping time period?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a really fun chapter to start to figure out and think through. And chapter two uses this concept that it's my own, but it I think emerges very much out of and kind of resonates with lesbian feminist language at the time, which is this concept of collective defense. Something a little bit different than a very personal notion of self-defense, and something that kind of points to the idea of lesbian feminist community as a site of protection and resistance to state violence and state power. So collective defense describes a whole range of kinds of activities. I first really noticed it through the group Gay Women's Liberation, or GWL, which was the first lesbian feminist organization to form in the Bay Area that was independent of earlier homophile organizations. And GWL included the participation of Judy Gron, Pat Parker, a number of other women, but Judy Gron and Pat Parker are among the sort of two of the best known members within it, two really important poets, of course. And GWL forms at the end of 1969, and one of its members' first actions is to join what was called a living wall of defense against police threats, a kind of a support gesture that had been asked for by the San Francisco chapter of the Black Panther Party. So this is, of course, at a moment when the Panthers, you know, in Los Angeles and elsewhere, kind of nationally, are facing increased state repression, and GWL members are some of the people who go out to sort of stand in support of the Panthers against that kind of repression. So they're clearly kind of engaged with and learning from a notion of some kind of defense against state power in that moment. And then they move on to kind of draw on their both, not only their specific ties to the Panthers, but sort of more broadly some of the ideas being mobilized by the Panthers to think more about gendered violence. So, for example, they participate in a local mini conference of the Panthers' Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention. They participate in this kind of mini conference within Berkeley and develop a set of demands to address gendered violence within the city of Berkeley. So that includes diverting some of the Berkeley police budget to women's liberation groups. It includes free 24-hour bus transportation for women. It includes women's rights to carry weapons, kind of a whole set of demands that I don't think the group was, you know, convinced that they would win, right? But it was a way to articulate a kind of agenda of women's self-protection, both kind of on their own terms and in relationship to other radical groups. From there, GWL goes on to continue to, so for example, they adapt the Panthers' practices of police patrols to confront individual men who they, you know, had evidence had harassed or assaulted women. So, for example, they use kind of a form of picketing to speak out against the man who had allegedly raped a dancer at a bachelor party. They stage interventions with individual men who had committed domestic violence against women in the network. So they're engaging in this kind of like creative readaptation of some of the kinds of strategies that they had been witnessing from the Panthers. And GWL then also feeds directly into some other somewhat better known work against rape in the Bay Area, for example, the formation of the San Francisco Women Against Rape, which was one of the first rape crisis centers in the U.S. The rest of the chapter then kind of moves on from this early history to look at a few different really important cases, primarily including the Inez Garcia case and then the Susan Sachs case. So lesbian feminists were really involved in supporting both of these women who were imprisoned for, you know, very different reasons, but reasons that activists were linking. So Inez Garcia was a Cuban and Puerto Rican woman who had been living in Soledad, California, in order to be near her husband, who was imprisoned in Soledad prison, which, importantly enough, of course, is the site where the Soledad III had been held. And while she's living there in Soledad, these two men who are acquaintances of her housemate attack her, rape her, then phone her afterwards to mock her. She goes to confront them, and they again attempt to attack her, and she fires on them, killing one of the men who had attacked her. So she you know, claims this as a self-defense case. You know, is initially actually sentenced to murder because the judge, you know, denies the self-defense claim. The judge and the jury deny the self-defense claim. She gets some initial support from local activists even in the first trial, but after she's convicted, she really sees a kind of even bigger campaign. And you see lesbian feminists really mobilizing in significant numbers to protest the case and to move towards the appeal. So the Inez Garcia case develops a tremendous amount of support from feminists in general, but including quite a number of lesbian feminists. And one of the things that's really interesting about her case that a number of people have talked about who are have been studying it is that activists define her and a few other women who are the subjects of really high-profile self-defense against rape cases at this time, including Joanne Little and others, they define these women as political prisoners. You know, because their right to bodily autonomy has been denied through their convictions or through the possible conviction that they may be facing, depending on the circumstances of each case. So what you see is that feminists are really kind of building on the broader language of political prisoner, which usually is used to apply to someone who has, you know, been accused of or has committed some kind of act that is clearly kind of organized with political intent. And they're using that kind of language to apply to women who have engaged in self-defense and to as a way to politicize work against rape. So the Inés García case is a really important sort of moment of mobilization for a lot of lesbian feminists in the Bay Area, although I also really try to look at some of the fissures that emerge in the campaign along lines of race, that it is also a site where you have primarily a network of white lesbian feminists working to support García, but not necessarily kind of drawing in or drawing strong connections to women of color who are organizing or other people of color who are organizing around her case. So I use that kind of as an example to look at the ongoing significance of collective defense, but also some of the tensions that are emerging around the organizing. And then the third example in the chapter looks at Susan Sachs, whose case was happening simultaneously with García's. And Susan Sachs was a white woman, and by the time her defense case came up as a public rallying cry, also identified as a lesbian. Sachs had been involved in a group in 1970 that had stolen some National Guard documents to reveal the extent of federal repression of anti-war activity, and then also had participated in a bank robbery that was intended to fund the Panthers, but during which one of the members of the group, a man in the group, wound up killing a Boston police officer. So after the course of that event, Sachs and Catherine Ann Power, her associate, went underground. And what became really significant was that they lived for about 5 years underground, mostly in lesbian feminist community. So, you know, that was how they were able to protect themselves and evade state repression. Sachs eventually surrendered herself for arrest, in part because grand juries and other forms of, you know, state agents were really coming after lesbian feminist communities because they had begun to figure out that this was where Sachs was hiding out. So Sachs surrenders herself for arrest, but in her arrest statement says that she's a lesbian, that she's a feminist, and says that the love that I share with my sisters is a more powerful weapon than any the state can bring to bear against us. So Sachs herself kind of defines lesbian feminist community and even eroticism or erotic links as a form of resistance to state repression.
Great. So let's look at from there. That takes us through all of this rich, complex stuff happening in the early 70s. And after looking at the lesbian feminists, you begin to profile gay organizing in the mid-70s, which is usually thought of as a time towards a more liberal analysis. But you found something different. Could you tell us about what happened during that period and how you made sense of it?
Sure, yeah. So this was a really interesting moment to look at because, as you say, the general account of gay and lesbian politics in the 1970s is this, you know, very radical beginnings that diminish and that move in directions of either continued radicalism but with very separatist undertones or very separatist kinds of cultural dimensions, or somewhat more coalitional but very liberal legal and rights-based agenda. And what I found was that while those two currents did exist, the sort of more separatist radicalism and more liberal kind of rights-based work, that there was also this other alternative that many, many gay and lesbian radicals were forming, that I was really the moment as I was researching that was when I really began to identify that over the course of a couple decades, you could describe a gay and lesbian left. So among gay men, what I started to see was that many of the same radicals who I kind of trace in the first chapter, who had initially I traced mostly through their kinds of debates with one another, by about 1973, 74, certainly 1975, they are beginning to form new organizations that, for example, borrow a lot from emerging socialist feminist models among women, that are looking to confront new sites, or not new sites of U.S. empire, but you know, sites of U.S. empire that are growing increasing attention as the war in Vietnam draws down. They are starting to think more and more about how gay men are very specifically affected by kind of gender divisions in the economy. So they draw on socialist feminist thought to think about gay men's experiences of discrimination on the job, their, you know, kind of concentration in relatively low-income service jobs, like as waiters and hairdressers, their discrimination on the job if they appear too effeminate, these kinds of problems. They begin to make inroads in forming some alliances with organized labor, particularly in the Bay Area. It takes a little longer nationally, of course, but there's really important work that starts to be done through kinds of solidarity campaigns on the Coors beer boycott, on the farm workers boycott, and other campaigns. They also begin then to translate some of those investments, those political investments, to a much broader and growing network of gay men's community that's itself, of course, growing in the Bay Area simply because of the kind of reputation of the Bay Area as a site of gay and lesbian community. So, you know, gay and lesbian community more broadly is growing in the Bay Area, and the gay and lesbian left is growing and speaking to that broader community. So in Chapter 3, I put a lot of emphasis on the growth of a group called Bay Area Gay Liberation, or BAGL, which has some roots in some smaller, more kind of ideological, socialist, feminist, gay men's networks. But by 1975, really responds to a moment of very intense police crackdown in the Castro that was known as the Castro Sweep. So it's this kind of convergence of, you know, kind of gay activists who have a long radical history with other men who have somewhat less developed politics, but are really upset by this very basic issue of policing, and are drawn in by the potential to kind of re-energize street protest and so forth. And so BAGL becomes a really significant organization that for a period of time has quite large meetings, you know, hundreds strong, is in many ways, I think, kind of the sort of the shock troops for much of the somewhat better known, more liberal gains that happened later in the decade through the defeat of Proposition 6, through the Harvey Milk's you know, final supervisor campaign. And so I try to kind of really lift out how BAGL and a number of other groups that it worked with, including the Third World Gay Caucus and others, really kind of created this potential for mass mobilization in the San Francisco Bay Area across the latter half of the 1970s. I think I'll stop there.
Yeah, Well, there's so much we could go into, but there's so much more still in the book. So let's move to, you know, moving a few years later after this emerging gay and lesbian left is taking hold. You turn to a little known facet of lesbian and gay activism in the late 70s and early 80s, which is the transnational solidarity with Nicaragua. So mm-hmm. can you tell us about the work that these activists were engaged in and why you found it to be so, so key to understanding what you were looking at?
Right. So the Nicaraguan solidarity movement in particular, and then more broadly, Central American solidarity, becomes a very important part of gay and lesbian politics in the 1980s nationally. And I found a lot of its roots in the Bay Area in the later 1970s. It's been really energizing to talk about this aspect of the book with audiences, as well as, of course, the people I interviewed, because routinely I get this kind of response, you know, of people being glad to know that anybody remembers that this was an important part of gay and lesbian politics, because it's been kind of so sort of swept away. But it really did mobilize large numbers of people and was not only kind of a broader movement in which gay and lesbian people participated, but also became a way that gay and lesbian left politics really were articulated, right? So it's not just a story of participation, but also of this kind of semi-autonomous and very specifically kind of transnational sexual politics. So the reason for why this connection emerges, there's a few different reasons. In the Bay Area, there's a very kind of localized which is that the Nicaraguan solidarity movement more broadly has some very strong roots in San Francisco. So there are, you know, Nicaraguan immigrants and exiles living in the Bay Area and particularly in San Francisco, really kind of for decades after the kind of institutionalization of the Somoza regime starting in the 1930s. But that community really grows by the early 1970s as the FSLN or the Sandinista movement is really developing in Nicaragua and in Mexico and with some footholds in Cuba and kind of across the Americas. Because, of course, you know, one of the things that's happening with the Sandinista movement is people aren't just organizing in Nicaragua. They're also leaving Nicaragua because they are persecuted as radicals there. And they are, you know, living for a period of time outside the country in order to kind of stay alive and in order to network with one another. So, you know, there's a few different people who are really important in this, who lots of other people have talked about, but who show up as significant in my story simply because of their local connections. Roberto Vargas is a Nicaraguan who kind of gets connected to solidarity work while having grown up in part in San Francisco and a number of other people. And they're mostly localized in the San Francisco Mission District, which is also by the 1970s becoming, you know, an important site of, in particular, lesbian community, and it's right next door to the Castro. So there's this very kind of neighborhood-based roots of transnational solidarity work that's going on. And this is also happening at a moment when many, many gay and lesbian activists are attempting to confront issues of racism and segregation within queer community. So, you know, groups like Bagel have been confronting practices of racism in gay bars. People connected to the Inez Garcia campaign have been trying to address kind of fissures around race in those campaigns. And as Nicaraguan solidarity develops as this kind of localized, you know, neighborhood-based, what another scholar, Carrie Cordova, calls barrio transnationalism, Nicaraguan solidarity and supporting it becomes a way to express one's, you know, allegiances and solidarity with kind of other issues and really just one's neighbors, right? So that's one of the key reasons that Nicaraguan solidarity becomes so important in the Bay Area, is just how localized it is. Another reason is that, you know, especially after 1981, once Reagan comes in, the new right globally is going after, you know, certainly going after gay and lesbian people, but also Reagan, of course, is supporting the Contras and trying to unseat the Sandinistas from power. So there's this kind of common enemy argument. And then the third reason is that the Sandinistas themselves have come into power in 1979 with really prominent existence of women leaders in the revolution, both in the military takeover and then in the government once they're in power after 79. So there's a kind of admiration of women's militancy that is both broadly feminist and connects in a lot of ways to the kind of rhetoric of lesbian feminist collective defense that had already been established. And that seems to many people to hold out a kind of promise for perhaps some, you know, much more literal gay and lesbian inclusion that might be able to occur in Nicaragua that might be different than, for example, some of the exclusions that people had seen in the Cuban Revolution. So this is all the kind of conceptual reasons for why Nicaraguan solidarity matters to the story. I first really discovered the existence of Nicaraguan solidarity just again through the archives. I really first noticed the connection while browsing in a bookstore in Oakland and noticing that somebody whose name I had, seen elsewhere in lesbian feminist work, and in fact, who I actually knew personally through my own past organizing in the Bay Area, Rebecca Gordon, that she had written this book about her time in Nicaraguan solidarity, which very much centers on the question of what is it to be a lesbian feminist working in solidarity with Nicaragua. And so I was kind of fascinated that, you know, this book had been published, that it clearly had been widely distributed enough to still find multiple copies in bookstores around the Bay Area, that I hadn't really ever heard about it from Rebecca herself, even though I knew her, because it had been taken for granted among many people of her generation that this was part of her history. So it didn't occur to her, I don't think, that she had to talk about this to a younger generation. But I could see that this was kind of part of a past history that I was really eager to uncover.
Wow. And that ends up being important even after that time, where you look at all these complex connections that people were building as the AIDS crisis begins to hit. So can you talk about some of the links that you found between the evolution of transnational solidarity with Nicaragua, transnational feminism, and AIDS activism as we move forward in the 80s?
Absolutely. There's so many really fascinating connections here. So There's two main ways that connections started to develop between Central American solidarity and AIDS activism. One was actually through prevention and care work. So chapter 5, which looks very closely at the formation of gay and lesbian brigades to Nicaragua, including the Victoria Mercado Brigade, which was the first gay and lesbian brigade to Nicaragua and was also purposefully majority women of color. I look at that group. And then I look at, kind of out of that, how is it that activists based in the Bay Area and Nicaraguan activists themselves, Nicaraguan gay and lesbian activists, talk to each other, and what kinds of exchanges did they have about transnational solidarity, about gay and lesbian politics in both the U.S. and Nicaragua? What kinds of resources did they exchange? You know, how did that influence become a very circular influence and not only one that kind of went from the Bay Area, you know, as if the chapter really tries to undermine the kind of assumption that we might make that if Bay Area gay and lesbian activists traveled to Nicaragua, that they must have been kind of exporting you know, sexual politics in Nicaragua or sort of teaching Nicaraguan gay and lesbian people how to organize. Quite the opposite. I really saw a lot of, you know, debate, exchange back and forth, and Nicaraguan gay and lesbian activists really very carefully manipulating international knowledge about their movement and about their goals. And one of the places that really emerged as a site of that exchange was by the late 1980s AIDS work. So after the Victoria Mercado Brigade, some of the same people in that group, and then a kind of slightly larger network, went back to Nicaragua to participate in a conference, a health conference, and to make a presentation about HIV and AIDS prevention and care. And Nicaraguan activists, as well as some people within the health ministry under the Sandinista government, kind of took on those resources and continued to work with some of the North American activists to advance AIDS work within Nicaragua. So that was kind of one aspect of the story, was, not so much the story of street protest around AIDS, but really the kind of, sort of community health model of activism. But this other side of the story I found was about street protest, and was the kind of ways that people took skills and lessons from anti-intervention civil disobedience work directly into the formation of direct action against the AIDS epidemic. So usually we tell the story of AIDS direct action just start to finish through ACT UP. So we sort of assume that the first group to engage in street protest around AIDS was ACT UP, starting in March 1987 in New York City. But what I found was that there are actually two organizations in San Francisco that began that kind of protest about 6 months before ACT UP initiated its work in New York: Citizens for Medical Justice and the AIDS Action Pledge. And both of those groups basically took individuals as well as tactics directly out of Central American solidarity protest organizations, including an anti-intervention group called the Pledge of Resistance. So just even the language of a pledge, the idea that individual people would pledge to engage in protest and civil disobedience against a key problem, was borrowed from Pledge of Resistance over into the AIDS Action Pledge. And in San Francisco, the AIDS Action Pledge continued to be active for about another year before it morphed into calling itself ACT UP San Francisco. So I trace out how that kind of anti-militarist politics shaped local organizing, for example, shaped the popularity of slogans like Money for AIDS, Not War, shaped the kinds of networks that people could call on if they were going to mobilize for a major protest, whether a Central America protest or an AIDS protest, shaped the ways that people thought about, using the idea of using kind of military funding and converting it into funding on the AIDS epidemic, which also then allowed them to rethink AIDS from a kind of framework of pathology or disease to a framework of public health needs. So I tried to trace out that history. And one of the things that I think is also really significant is that those same connections also show up in 1987 in the March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights, which is the second March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights, right, immediately after the one that had happened in 1979. That march, 2 days after the march, people organized a massive civil disobedience at the Supreme Court that protested both the recent Supreme Court Bowers decision, maintaining laws against sodomy, and protested federal inaction on the AIDS epidemic. And the handbook for that Supreme Court civil disobedience, which was really just the second largest mass civil disobedience and mass arrests in the Capitol, second only to a Vietnam War protest in 1971, the handbook really cites all the history that I had uncovered, right? So it talks about gays and lesbians in Central America, gays and lesbians in the anti-nuclear movement. How is it that we know how to commit civil disobedience? You know, the people of color in the gay and lesbian movement, right? How is it that we know how to think through, or how is it that we're attempting to think through issues around race and ethnicity in relationship to sexual identity and sexual politics? So the handbook really emerged for me as a key archive of that chapter that really encapsulated the power of people's awareness of radical history as something that could motivate them in that particular moment.
Wow, so much there. That's exciting. So we're in the 90s and there's so much more we could do, but let's move into where you take us from the 90s to the present with all of this groundwork that you found in the Bay Area. You turn to looking at LGBTQ radicalism sort of nationally from the 90s to the present and some of the shifts that were happening that were related to that. Could you share what you see as the major developments during that time?
Sure. Well, and the bulk of the action of the book ends about 1991. I don't really make any claims to writing a history of queer radicalism in the 1990s, okay. But I do try to kind of sweep through some major events in that moment. I actually make an argument that I describe the gay and lesbian left as moving from about 1968, and then, of course, after 1969, through about 1991. And I describe it as ending in that moment, in part because, of course, we start to see, you know, certainly by 1991 and really even a few years earlier, the emergence of a much more decisively queer politics that contests some of the kinds of framing of identity that had certainly marked the gay and lesbian left that were, although more fluid than I think we often give credit, certainly more invested in a kind of clear containers around gay and lesbian as distinct, you know, sexual identities, and also as distinct from bisexual and as distinct from transgender and so forth. You know, so by the late 1980s, we see a queer politics that is contesting that pretty clearly, and that starts to shift away from some of the networks that had really defined the gay and lesbian left. That's one reason for that difference. But I also describe the gay and lesbian left as wrapping up by about 1991, because in large part that I really noticed the impact of AIDS itself on the networks and the organizations I was examining. That just as growing numbers of activists themselves died, that, you know, of course, groups changed, their membership changed, their rhetoric changed, and this kind of passing down of that generation's radical history really was arrested by the epidemic itself. So I mark that as a break for a couple different reasons. You know, the shift in kind of language around sexuality itself, the impact of AIDS, and of course the end of the Cold War, which also dramatically alters the meanings of the left and leaves, I think, a lot of people kind of adrift as they figure out, you know, what is the sort of unifying politics in the aftermath of the Cold War for progressive and left people. So some of the things that then happen after that I kind of speed my way through in the epilogue include, for example, the really decisive shift towards and kind of, you know, mainstream rise of the fight for gay and lesbian inclusion in the military, which gay and lesbian leftists had never really been invested in, had really opposed. You know, they had come out directly out of anti-war and anti-militarist organizing and were not interested in advocating for military inclusion. But of course, that was a goal that did draw in a fair number of people who didn't have connections to a broader left politics. So I trace out how that became a moment of real kind of disappointment for the gay and lesbian left, and how a kind of, you know, alternate form of queer radicalism continued to exist, right, although be under-recognized across the 1990s and through the 2000s and, of course, through to today. But I really try to name the past few years as a moment of resurgence of queer radicalism. You know, certainly nothing really went away over the past couple decades, since the early 1990s, but I have noticed quite a bit more upsurge in investments in a radical queer critique through all kinds of things, Palestinian solidarity, through the really strong growth of trans immigrant organizing and trans of color organizing, and also through the ways, in particular, I really name in the epilogue the growth of Black Lives Matter as a formation in which there are not only many, you know, very much self-identified queer leaders, right? Lisa Garza, Patrice Cullors, and many members in BYP 100, but also the ways that Black Lives Matter really has issued such a sharp challenge to a kind of politics of kind of normative gender, of, you know, kind of normative respectability in how people ought to interact with police, of sort of normative respectability in terms of, you know, what kinds of targets of violence ought to be named as worthy of defense, right? So I'd really try to lift up some of the ways that Black Lives Matter and the mobilization for Black Lives has certainly, from, you know, looking from within it, made a strong effort to connect to efforts like Say Her Name and work among, you know, defending Black trans lives and other kinds of, you know, broad issues that we would name as very clearly visibly queer, and that they've articulated a connection between those kinds of cases and the cases that the media continues to tend to focus in much more clearly of cis men, right, who are being assaulted, who I think are often identified as the most visible targets in part because they reinforce the dominant narrative that argues that anybody killed by police, you know, somehow must have actually been violent and aggressive, right? So to focus in on cis men sort of allows people to assume that somehow those people murdered deserved it, right? Whereas if we really start to name the ways that Black women also are incredibly frequent targets of police violence, and Black trans people are incredibly frequent targets of police violence, then we'll have to be a little bit more open about the ways that clearly the problem is the police violence, right? And that it's about the sort of perception of the person attacked, and not, you know, something inherent about their behavior.
Great. So you you cover so much ground in this book, and we've taken up a lot of your time. I'm so glad that we've been able to talk about all the rich, multifaceted aspects of your topic. Can you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. So there's two major things I've been working on. One is that I'm working with my friend and colleague Dan Berger, author of Captive Nation, among other texts. He and I are working on a primary source anthology of radicalism from about 1973 to 2001 is about the time frame we're considering, and working on compiling primary sources, you know, brief case studies of organizations, and so forth. And our goal in that anthology is in part to provide students and researchers and teachers a resource to really dig into histories of social movements, and the focus is on radicalism within the United States, although, of course, with kind of transnational and global awareness built in. We want to give people a way to really look at the continuation of radical movements after the height of the long 1960s, right? Because too often students can take a 1960s course, right? But they can't really take a course that acknowledges the incredible breadth and vibrancy of social movements after that period, right? So therefore we reify this notion that everything happened like in this, you know, brief period of time that is now for our contemporary students really quite a long time ago. So we're working on this anthology that we're really excited about. And then another project that I'm working on that's, you know, just my own research project that I'm beginning to develop comes straight out of Lavender and Red, but it's trying to look at the connections between AIDS activism and prison radicalism in the 1980s and 90s, and in particular to focus in on AIDS activism that was developed by prisoners inside prisons and by former prisoners as well. One of the reasons for my interest in this is, well, first of all, that simply I found all these, you know, archives in the research that I was doing for the last chapter that looks at the ties between Central American solidarity and AIDS direct action. You know, it's sort of one part of some of those boxes kept showing that they're one of the places that a lot of different activists I was looking at then went kind of after moving on from some of the direct action work was that they were looking at the issue of AIDS in prisons. So one was, you know, just the archives were clearly taking me to this topic. And the other thing is that I've started to notice that a lot of these early AIDS prevention efforts that happened in prisons had some kind of connection to political prisoners. So political prisoners were involved in these efforts and often were the kind of communication, the node of communication between efforts that were going on inside with then activists who were supportive on the outside. So I'm really intrigued by this kind of undertold story. And one of the questions I'm hoping to be able to address is how is it that the HIV/AIDS movement and epidemic really helps to inform prison abolition as we know it today.
That sounds great. So your book covers so much about past activism, and now a lot of people are asking questions about how to make social change now, how to be engaged, and how to answer some of these longstanding issues that you talk about in your book. What do you see as the relevance of the research that you did and what you found for our current political moment?
Right. I mean, it's such an important question. And of course, you know, I finished the book in the summer of 2016, before the election, before the inauguration of Trump, and really also, of course, before this moment of quite dynamic resistance that we so need to sustain. And so I've been trying to think about what the book can say to this moment of incredible change, of just volatility, right? And there's two things I've really thought about. One, I think about through the word genealogy, which, you know, sometimes we think about genealogy in a, typically, I suppose, we think about genealogy in a very heteronormative kind of way, right? Who are our grandparents and great-grandparents and so on and so forth. But I try to also think about genealogy in a somewhat broader kind of way where I think about, you know, as an individual activist, who have I been mentored by? Who have my mentors been mentored by? And then, of course, then applying that to the kinds of history I'm trying to trace, in what ways did mentorship and relationships across movement moments and generations shape some of the politics I'm tracking, right? So I really try in the book to talk about individuals who appear and reappear at different moments and how they learn from one another and how they took lessons from one setting and applied it to the next. I think that the last chapter that also tries to reflect on the ways that the AIDS epidemic made it difficult to sustain awareness of such genealogy really brought home for me how important that kind of connection is. So I think one really broad lesson is that it it can be very helpful to us to know what has come before, what kinds of tactics have been used, and that just because a movement did not, you know, ultimately transform the world in some absolute way doesn't mean that it didn't win some very important victories and also develop some very important tactics, lessons, and so forth. So I'm a real big believer in the power of connecting with each other across kind of movement generations, whether those are literal generations of age or simply a kind of historical moment, and of trying to trace out genealogies so that we know kind of where we have come from, both for better and for worse. And then the other really big concept, I mean, of course, solidarity is a really important keyword to my book, and I really try to argue that solidarity and liberation are formed through each other. But I've also been thinking a lot about how solidarity might be different than just the notion of alliance. So we often hear a lot about, you know, calling on people to be allies, right? Or when I, you know, first got a job at my institution, University of Nevada, Reno, I could put a sticker on my door that said I was an ally, a queer ally, right? And I've never put that sticker on my door because I'm not a queer ally. I'm just queer. And I don't, I'd rather put things on my door that make that apparent than to decide that the only way that I can claim some kind of politics of support is through this language of alliance that I think in some ways, right, allows the person claiming it to kind of remove themselves from the identity. You know, I've seen lots of that in some of the language around alliance that tends to reinforce the notion of a kind of separation between the person who claims themselves as ally and the thing that they are in alliance to. And I think solidarity is different. I think solidarity encourages us to see our interests as interconnected, to see us a little bit more in one another, even while also acknowledging differences. There's a framing from Sarah Ahmed that I really love about solidarity that, you know, it allows us to recognize that we don't live in the same bodies, we don't have the same feelings, but we do live on common ground, right? And that it is this thing that is constantly, you know, being, we're never quite getting there, right? It's something that we aspire towards, but it really only gains power by us constantly sort of questioning whether we have achieved it and constantly sort of self-critiquing it. So I try to think about solidarity in that kind of a way as not the same as alliance and as something that allows us to really kind of see ourselves in one another. And that, I think, is something that I have felt quite a bit of hope for in this moment. You know, I keep waiting with bated breath for LGBTQ politics to be decisively divided from, you know, opposition to the Muslim ban and so forth. And so far, I haven't seen that happen. So far, I have seen queer folks, both, you know, Muslim and then certainly non-Muslim, really standing up and saying, we know that we have the same opposition right now, and that might allow us to, you know, reject the kind of language that would divide us from one another. It's a little bit easier when you have such a clear enemy like the Trump administration, but my hope is always that in these moments of a really clear enemy that we can take some lessons from that will then sustain us later at moments when the division might seem easier to allow.
Great. Well, thank you so much for drawing out those lessons.
Emily, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you for discussing your book with us today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in History. This is your host, Isabel Moore.